Hey, if you're looking for a light upgrade, why not buy the last light you'll ever need? Go to elspelio.com, and all regularly priced headlamps are $20 off with the promo code PODCAST. Either that or any order over $300. Any regularly priced order over $300, you'll save $20 with the promo code PODCAST. Go to elspelio.com. I use the Terra. I love that Terra. Get yourself one at elspelio.com. The link is in the description of this podcast. This is the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto. I'm a little under the weather, which you may or may not be able to hear. I am hopped up on Sudafed and ibuprofen. It is not COVID, at least I'm pretty darn sure. I don't have a fever, but geez, it's just a good old classic cold that I caught from my 1 year old. And he's doing fine because he's got those baby superpowers. What is caving? If you're here for the first time, welcome. This is a podcast about caving, cave exploration. You may find when you do a little bit of research that, secretive might be an adjective to describe the caving community. It's one that is not without merit. That's for sure. Because we want to protect these resources. We want to protect these places. We also want to protect your safety because caving can be dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. Quite the opposite if you do know what you're doing. So if you want to try caving, get in touch with a grotto. That is like a local chapter of the National Speleological Society here in the United States. There's caving clubs all over the world, though. Find yours, and you can find one in the U.S. by going to caves.org, which is the NSS website. Go to caves.org and look for the nearest grotto to you. There you can find contact information with some of the grotto leadership, and you can email them, and you can find out who is the person in the grotto who likes to take new people. They'll take you to some of the best spots. They'll show you around. They'll tell you what gear to buy and all that kind of stuff. So, again, go to caves.org and get in touch with the right people. This month, we are talking to Sam Freshour. He is an Indiana caver from way back. He drew the map of one of my favorite Indiana caves, Sullivan Cave. And we'll talk about that a little bit. He was also on a couple of the big expeditions to help map that cave. It was just such a joy to talk to him. We'll get to more on Sam here in a little bit. Although I must express my condolences and my deepest sympathy to Sam and his partner, Patty, Patty Cummings, who is also a prominent caver in the Bloomington, Indiana area, lost her son, Chuck, to a heart attack last month. It was very sudden. I didn't know Chuck, but I know Sam and I know Patty, and my heart goes out to them. We recorded this interview before Chuck passed away. So that's why there's no acknowledgement of it in the episode. But Chuck was a big caver as well. He was into caving in Indiana, and his ashes were spread at Buckner, which I thought was very befitting. So rest in peace, Chuck Cummings, and Sam and Patty, my sympathies to you. Indiana Cave Capers was a success. I did not make it, but I heard that it went off without a hitch, and there were some great guidelines in effect, social distancing, masks in common areas, and from all I heard, it sounded like it was a great time, and I was sorry that I had to miss it. Good on my grotto, the Central Indiana Grotto, for putting that on and doing it safely. I appreciate it, and I'm glad to share that information. I have not been caving. Very few people have. I'm thinking about doing a trip this weekend into Sullivan Cave, incidentally. Just a little tourist trip with my wife and my sisters-in-law who like to go caving with me every once in a while. But I did do something really fun this past month. I was the presenter for the Nashville Grotto August meeting. Thanks to Ray Maslach for that. That was a great time. He asked me to present about the podcast. And I went in there and I brought a bunch of clips from previous episodes and shared. Man, that was fun. And so now, if you are in charge of presentations for your grotto and you would like for me to bring that presentation to you, I am happy to do so on a virtual basis. So you can reach out to me. You can find me in the directory. I'd be happy to do that. It was a great, great time. And I need one more female caver to round out this year with 50-50 representation, male-female, just like last year. I was proud of that. I was very proud of that, and I'll be proud of it again this year. So if you or someone you know is a prominent female caver and would like to talk to me for the podcast, I'm looking for my December interview. And so I would appreciate it. Again, reach out to me, find me in the directory. And if I don't hear from anybody, you better believe I'm going to be looking somebody up. So thanks for that. All right. Sam Freshour is an Indiana caver, and he goes back a long, long way. He wrote the book, A Guide to Caves and Karst of Indiana, which came out in 2012. And he is just a wealth of knowledge, as you'll hear, and I could not wait to talk to him. And we got started off right away, just dove right in on the Indiana stuff. So if you're curious about Indiana caving and Indiana caves, this is definitely an episode for you. If you're not, hey, stick around anyway, because we've got some pretty cool stuff here in Indiana. All right, here's me and Sam Freshour. Look what I got.
Oh no, that rag.
I have not read it cover to cover, but it's one of my favorite things to just pick up and open to whatever page. So I just wanted to show you what a fan I already am. And I've got the Sullivan map on my garage, my garage wall. I've got two boys. 3 and almost 1, and my almost 1-year-old is named Sullivan, not after the cave, but
that's very kind of you.
It's unofficially named after the cave, but it's not officially after the cave. But anyway,
and I could enlighten you a little bit as to why it's called Sullivan Cave,
please, because I've never heard that before.
Well, you've got to realize that the hill north of Sullivan Cave, actually the ridge, is Sutherland Ridge. There was a fellow in the 1890s named Sutherland that bought up a bunch of property to then start limestone quarries. And that was known as Sutherland Ridge for many years and Sutherland Cave. And somehow it got corrupted, probably in the 1930s or 40s. We don't know when.
It's just a mistake.
It's a mistake. Yep.
Oh man, that just cracks me. I mean, I feel like there's a lot of stories about caves like that, though.
Buckner Cave, the Buckner family only owned that cave for just a few years, like 3 or 4 or 5 years. But the predecessors, the Blairs, owned it for like 40 years or 50 years.
Wasn't it called Blair Cave for a little while, or was it also known as Blair
Cave? Way back when it was, but somehow it got changed to Buckner Cave, probably in the 1930s or 40s, maybe in the 50s. We don't know for sure either on that one.
So do they own all that land up there, and that's why we have Queen and King Blair?
Queen Blair and King Blair are very modern, recent names. Those springs that where those caves are, where the water comes out, were known as Big Blair Spring and Little Blair Spring historically.
Ah, okay.
Those names, King and Queen Blair, come from the 1960s.
So cavers named those?
Yes.
Okay. So at the time when that was all being explored in that area?
Yes. Well, in fact, let's see, by people like David DeMaray, Bill Steele, Ted Petronoff. These are famous cavers of the time.
Sure, sure.
And, well, of course, Dick Blends, and I'm sure there were some others. Well, even Art Geheimer was kind of active then, and Don Paquette.
Yeah, I've had him on.
Let's see, the Rodemakers, Jim and Craig Rodemaker, they were from Chicago. The Bittingers from Texas, they were involved for a while. It was a national group, basically.
So I think it was not the most recent BIG meeting, but the one before that, you guys are meeting on the Buckner property.
Yes, we had the last two meetings on the Buckner property.
Yeah, which I think is a great idea because it's there's a lot of space there and you can kind of keep away from each other and socially distance and all that. And I think it was the last, not the last one, but the one before that, that you, at least it was on the description on Facebook, that you were going to lead a walk through the property. And I've never gotten to actually... What's that?
I did a historical tour.
Yeah, and I wanted to come to that meeting just to be on that.
We have a hiking trail that does that.
Yeah, and so I've gone by Ginger Pit, but that's as far as I've ever gone there.
Okay, and if you go from the Buckner Cave to Ginger Pit and then follow the trail, you end up at Jim's Hole. That was a dig, of course, and the Rodemakers were paramount in that one, and Dick as well. And if you continue on around, you... across the dry bed, which is the dry bed that eventually would lead you back to Buckner. And up the hill, the upper entrance of Queen Blair is there. The trail goes past those.
So what would I have heard on that tour?
Well, I'm going to talk about a little bit about the history of the early history of Buckner as far as pre-1958, because that cave was known at least in the early 1800s, maybe a little earlier, and a little bit about how the cave was rediscovered by Dick Powell and Jim Langhammer in 1958. And then I discussed Ginger Pit and why it's called Ginger Pit,
why is it?
Okay. Ginger was the name of Uldis Dusilus' girlfriend.
And who?
Uldis Dusilus. He is somebody I went to high school with.
Okay.
He is now a high-energy particle physicist that travels between MIT and Bern, Switzerland. For certain, yeah.
Wow, that's intense.
Yeah. He could be retired now. He was thinking about it. I went to high school with a bunch of nerds, and that's when we took up caving.
So Ginger Pit. All right. So we've unlocked that mystery.
The reason it's Ginger Pit was he named it for his girlfriend because he stood on a spot where there was a little depression and the ground collapsed under him and he was up to his waist standing on a ledge above a 12-foot pit.
And that's all that's as far as that thing goes, right?
Well, no, not exactly.
No?
At one point, we dug it out to 36 feet deep, hoping to find more cave. And all we got was a little drain that as far as you could stick an arm or see, was solid rock. It was too very, very small. We did a little bit of chemical removal of rock, which was for naught.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, and over the years, erosion has pretty much filled it back in.
Okay. And so, all right, so... Buckner is like it's my go-to cave just because you can do a little bit of everything in there and there's no risk of if bad weather comes, it's not going to flood. And I know it. And so I like going there. I'm the kind of person who likes to go back to the same caves over and over again. I'm not a very good caver in that regard, but I do appreciate my good Indiana caves and Buckner's one of them. And I want to know as much about, I mean, and we don't have to spend all the time we have tonight on Buckner, but I want to know a lot more about Buckner than I already know. And you wrote up an historic brief on one of the versions of the maps, the latest map, the Sean Lewis map. And I have that map blown up as big as I can have it on my garage wall right next to your Sullivan map. And it's got your little historical write-up on there. But I understand, I mean, you probably only had very few words to kind of sum that up.
I don't even remember what I said, but okay.
Well, you had said that it's been popular since the late 50s or early 60s, and then Dick Blends bought it, and then it's kind of just the back cover.
We can go through a quick and dirty history.
Let's do it.
Okay, because... it was known way back when, and there was an L.V. Cushing scratched in the rock near the stream that said L.V. Cushing 1775. That may have been his birth date, not the visitation date.
Still.
That might have been a birth date. That was somewhat common. A lot of people didn't know what the real date was, but they knew when they were born.
Okay, well, I haven't heard that yet. I had always heard that 1775 was when people believed he was there.
Yeah. Now, there were one of the things we did with Pat Munson, an archaeologist, was collect shagbark hickory torch remains, and they were carbon dated to about the time of that date.
Okay.
They were not Aboriginal at all. They were from about that period.
Okay. All right. But that could also mean that that was his birth date. I mean, you, carbon dating is definitely not within 25 years as far as accuracy, right?
We don't, I don't know. It was plus or minus 25 years or something like that. Yeah. 25 or 50 years. I don't remember off the top of my head. But anyway, the L.V. Cushing, Pat Munson tracked him. He was a Canadian. The Cushing family, when they came to this, the New World, divided. Some went to Canada. Some came to the colonies. And anyway, he apparently was a Canuck who came down to Vincennes and was at Vincennes for some period of time. And apparently came through Indiana at some point.
And hilly Indiana, for that matter.
Yeah. And anyway, during the late 1800s, the area, of course, was timbered. There was poor farming practices. And somewhere around the late 1890s, a lot of material was washed in the entrance and filled in what we now call the crawlway a large extent, at least 4 feet near the entrance.
They think the crawlway used to be a lot deeper than that?
It was probably a stoopway.
Okay.
Yeah.
Huh.
It was probably a stoopway. And because if you go more than halfway through it, it becomes a stoopway for a distance.
Sure.
And then, anyway, in the 1920s, some rowdies of those Buckners dug it open, and they explored the cave some. We have a map that is undated. It comes from either the Clyde Mallott collection or the Thornberry collection, or could have been. But anyway, it's from Dick Powell. It was given to Dick Powell. I have a copy of it. It shows the entrance, shows the crawlway. It shows the big passage going to the left of the crawlway. It shows the stream and going downstream a few hundred feet, 300 feet, and upstream to breakdown.
Uh-huh.
This map may be from the 1920s, but it also may be earlier.
Huh.
And this is something that Dick Powell, he had this map. He couldn't figure out what cave it was. But one day he threw it on his desk in disgust. It spun around and he looked at it and he recognized the entrance room of Buckner. And then he and Jim Langhammer and Bob Armstrong went to Buckner to see about digging it open. Bob Armstrong, you know, Bugs.
Yeah.
Rolled rock and went up into the breakdown and rolled rocks, trying to see if that's the way it went.
Sure.
Dick Powell and Jim Langhammer dug into where they figured on the map it was. It took them a half an hour to dig in. Only a half an hour.
That was it.
And then they...
How'd they know where to look, or did they just get lucky?
Well, they just looked at that line map and took angles, because there's passage walls on that map. But
okay.
they're very crude. Well, anyway, one of the things that Dick Powell found in the crawlway was a 1906 half dime. That's a little silver coin that was essentially worth 5 cents at the time, but they were called a half dime. So that could have been lost in there sometime in the 1920s.
Wow.
Anyway, after it had been dug open, more material washed in and closed off what we call thunder crawl. They're scratched above it, turn down under, and go to thunder. Thunder is another word for hell.
Okay. And
for them that don't know.
Yeah. And that's the real tight one. The really, really tight entrance that's now kind of filled in.
We have it clogged with rocks right now because we have a gate elsewhere.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that opened up Buckner. It was Dick mapped it. He mapped in much of it and around the circle route. And then Greg Spaulding added to Dick's map. And that's the map, the older map that you generally see. And then, of course, Sean Lewis remapped the cave. And he actually added a little bit here and there. But he did some wonderful corrections to some passages that were probably at the wrong angle because of magnetic interference. A lot of people don't understand that, you know, carrying their their lunch in a can near the compass just does not work, you know, that sort of thing. Or, you know, reading the compass near a steel belt buckle, or even actually near, in the days of carbide lamps, the reflector was often steel. Not on all of them, but some of them were steel. And so it's something to be concerned about, is that magnetic deviation from interference.
Would you say you've been all through Buckner?
I have been in all but a few little places. Like, I've never been to the end of BS Crawl South. Let's see, have I been? I've been real close to the end of BS Crawl North.
And where it sumps there? Or have you been in that room that's on Powell and Spalding's map that isn't on Sean's map?
Then BS Crawl, you mean?
Yeah, BS North.
That's because Spalding, for two reasons. It sumps. There's a puddle there, and it sumps.
Yeah.
That's the only place he couldn't get to, was that through that sump.
Oh, okay.
And it's very low. In fact, way back when, one of the people, when Spalding was mapping, one of the people held his breath and went through that dang thing. About 10 feet. And he thought it was more, but it was probably about 10 feet.
Gosh.
That's a little foolish because it's pretty tight. Yeah.
Is that seasonal, or is it just you gotta get lucky?
I don't know. I really couldn't tell you. Don't know on that one. But I've been pretty much everywhere else. I'm sure I'm at the bottom of the waterfall, there's a crawlway through in the stream that I've not been to the end to. I've been through a good bit of it, but not the end. It's pretty grim.
I tried to do that myself, and it's not fun.
It's not fun at all. No. And I was doing that when I was a lot skinnier too. I'm not fat now, but I was a lot skinnier.
So,
incidentally, I was in Buckner Cave before Dick Blends was.
That's so wild to me.
The year before.
Oh, man. So you got to know him pretty well then, when he was.
We got to know him very well through the years, because you got to realize that he was one of the members of the second Sullivan Cave expedition that I was also on.
Yeah, he was a Sullivan here too.
Yes.
Yeah. So you were one of the Sullivaneers, one of the people I wasn't sure if you were one of them, or if you just took their data and drew the map. I know you've spent plenty of time in Sullivan, but you spent the whole two, three weeks?
To finish that map, I hitchhiked or took a bus down to Ulitic to finish this map, and on two different occasions, and hiked all the way to Sullivan Cave from there, and went in the cave and spent literally days finishing out little passages, mapping by myself.
Doing little, oh boy. Any highlights from that?
Up to the North Rise.
So,
check some data.
By yourself?
By myself.
Oh my gosh. That's a big trip. I've done that trip once. And So you were doing cleanup for the map. Highlights from that? Anything you had to go back and get?
Mapping some of the major passages too, and during the expedition. But there's, for all practical purposes, after 1965, there was no mapping by anybody.
Yeah.
The Sullivaneers were kind of going here and there. They were, you know, they were spreading out into the, you know, their lives were doing their lives elsewhere.
Yeah. Well, it's such a big cave. I mean, and the map is dated, 1973?
Yes.
And I don't know. I mean, just looking back, and I mean, I feel even weird asking because you did the map, but do you feel like it's pretty comprehensive, or do you feel like that cave goes anywhere?
The passages that would go are the north end of the backbreaker. That's just a collapse.
Yeah.
And it's the same collapse that is all the way down at the north end of the quarry room. It's right above you. It's the same collapse.
Same one.
Yeah.
I guess, because it overlays.
We did a bunch of digs there in the 64 and 65. We did a bunch of digs there, and some other people did later on, and we extended that passage, but it would just take so much rock removal. We literally moved tons of rock as it was and extended the passage quite a bit. It would take, actually, the tunneling would, if it got to be where we probably would have to actually drill and blast. We did some blasting as it was to break up rocks. And I was the guy that ramrodded all that. I have a long history of of such matters and a lot of successes.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, we wouldn't do it if we wouldn't get through a few times. And so, well, and of course, the other obvious continuation is north of the rise, right?
Yes, but that would be by way of diving.
Of course.
And just getting the gear up there. Cave diving gear is nothing like open water gear. And, you know, the amount of material to haul that distance is you need a lot of Sherpas.
Yeah. But just knowing the passage leading up to that, I mean, do you think it would be significant enough to check it out? Maybe worth it to bring stuff back there?
Somebody should. I'm getting too old to do that.
But you do some of that, right?
I've been a cave diver for almost 30 years. But that's it's the going caving. It's the not the diving. It's the caving part. Because that's I got my knee between my knees and, yeah, and just old age. It'd be an awfully hard trip on me. But yeah, now, the issue there is the fact that all that collapse at room 7 and 8 has the water blocked up. It's dammed up there.
Yeah, it is.
So it could be just horrendously long distance before you got to air. I mean, potentially it could be a horrendously long distance. And that much of the that water is from Linden Hollow and the ridges beyond Linden Hollow to the north is probably where that water is from. It's a pretty good sized drainage area.
Fascinating. I remember when we headed up that way. I've only done that trip once. When was the last time you've been up to the rise?
Oh my, let's see. It was in the 90s.
Okay.
Early 1990s.
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't been up there since the 90s.
It was a great trip. I mean, I look back on that as like my favorite caving trip. It's hard to pick a favorite.
I've talked to people that claimed it was a harder trip than some of the, than Binkley's even. And Binkley's is bodacious for that.
Yeah. Well, let's see, how much experience do you have in Binkley's?
Well, I've not been in the new stuff at all. I've been in the old historic stuff and around the circle route. And the very first cave I ever mapped in was with people in the BIG in 1961. And that was Binkley Cave.
Aha.
Very first time. That was very green, too.
What areas?
It was somewhere near the mountain room.
Okay.
Some passage near the mountain room. It's been a long time. Yeah. I think I could pick it out on a map, but it was at the near the mountain room. I think we were climbing around up or in or somewhere near the mountain room anyway in Binkley.
Yeah, gorgeous around there. Yeah, I mean, I just remember doing the rise trip in Sullivan and looking around. And I mean, you know, it's such a long trip. And so there's so much of that trip where you're just kind of just moving through and there's not much to see. There's really not much to see.
Yeah, there's some long just tunnel.
Yeah.
That, you know, fortunately, there's a fair amount of just scrambling too.
Yeah.
To think about it, you know, you walk through the walking areas pretty quick. And the rooms are just fantabulous, really. They're really neat. Those big collapse rooms all along the main stream are just tremendous. And of course, then the Colossus room is the crowning jewel of height anyway. It's tremendous room there.
Yeah.
And on two occasions when I was in that room, a rock fell off the wall.
Oh my gosh, really?
Yep. just stomping around and talking and a rock would fall.
Oh my word. A big one?
Like watermelon size rocks.
That's big enough.
Yep. I've been hit by a watermelon size rock once.
Oh no. Where was that?
Oh, it was in a little pit called Above Easter Pit down in the Wyandotte region. And I was with Todd Webb, if anybody knows Todd Webb. It was only about a 12-foot, 15-foot pit, and we rappelled in, and he was going to climb out, and he couldn't climb the rope without it being taut. So I had to hold the rope, and when he got to the top, I heard him yell, "Rock." He had dislodged a rock that was on a ledge. All I could do was kind of cringe, and that 40-pound rock came right down over and hit my hard hat at the lamp. broke the hard hat and landed at my feet, and it drove me to my knees.
Oh.
I got a minor contusion out of it.
Oh, my God.
And I, instead of climbing, putting my prusik slings on the rope, I just went ahead and held onto the rope and climbed the ledges out. It was easy. Let's just say the major issues I've had with accidents in caves have been in that same area, the Wyandotte area. I got hit by a 40-pound rock, and I got bit by a copperhead.
Oh, ow. Okay, how do you come back from that? Like, was not much venom released, I guess?
Didn't get me very badly, okay. No. We were uncovering a cave entrance that had been hidden. I was lifting a rock up, and apparently I disturbed his happy home, and he got me on the wrist.
Wow. Ooh, that's scary. I was down in Tag one time sitting next to a timber rattler for, gosh, I don't know how long. I mean, I was sitting there waiting to do a pit, and I look over, and he's sitting right there. He all coiled up, and I'm looking down at him, and it's like, are you cool? I'm cool. We cool? All right.
The rattlers are a lot, they're not as near as aggressive as copperheads seem to be.
Yeah, yeah.
They're a little more laid back.
All right, so we've gone to Buckner. We've talked a little bit about Sullivan. Any more about Sullivan? Because I just love going back to Sullivan. I mean,
I can tell you what my favorite areas are.
Please.
Yes, the stream passage is neat. The rectangle crawl Grand Canyon area is really just neat to play around in, because you can, one of the ways to get into that area is either down the helictite passage and, you know, under the wall, and or the what we call the back door of the mountain room, where you can get into that area from the mountain room. And anyway, that area was discovered by the old Scottsburg Grotto in the early 1950s. In fact, there's a room called the Scotto Grotto Room.
Yeah, been there.
Yeah. Anyway, that whole area is just fun to travel around in. The water room at the very end had a collapse and a sinkhole open up to the surface in about 1975. I don't know if anybody's dug open into that water room anymore. That used to be known as the wettest part of Sullivan Cave until Art and Davis and John Danner discovered the mountain room in 56. You know, there was no stream known, and it is a multi-level cave. It's really interesting from the standpoint of its development, because you have the main bore of the backbreaker. You have canyons that connect that upper level to the stream level. On the stream level, you have some meanders. Like, have you been to Armstrong's Folly?
I have, yeah.
Well, Bob Armstrong spent, I don't know, about a dozen weekends digging that, and with help from other people. And this was in the old 1959 to 60. And what he was doing was following a very weak airflow. He even camped there. And he had rails in there, wooden rails, and then a little trestle built out to dump the dirt down the hill towards the stream. Well, that's all rotted away.
Sure.
And his even had a wooden cart that ran on those rails, and somebody vandals dumped it in the stream years ago.
Yeah.
But anyway, that passage, if you really look, unfortunately, Bob was a very industrious fellow, but he didn't figure out the cave in that instance. If you go downstream, almost to the spiral room, if you look up on the left, there's a big muddy alcove where that passage comes back in.
The one he was digging on?
Probably what it is. That's just an abandoned upper part of the same passage, and then it meandered at a lower level and left that up, you know, abandoned that upper part for a while. And anyway, another story is the spiral room. It used to be you could climb down in the hole in the spiral room and get to the stream downstream from that sump. But people have rolled rocks in and covered up the holes that went down to that stream, and you could follow the stream downstream a ways, but eventually it ended in breakdown.
Yeah. Well, it's tricky to find the stream in there, I've heard. You know, I've actually not been to the spiral room. As much as time as I've spent in Sullivan, I've never been down that way to the south.
Well, there is, and if you want to go out the Speed Hollow entrance, you know, it doesn't matter how wet you are. But if you want to stay relatively dry, going to the spiral room, when after you leave Armstrong's Folly, you go across the stream and up over a mud bank, and there is a ledge on the right that you climb up on that ledge out of the stream and follow it, and it bypasses the part of the stream that's over waist deep. Hey, we learned that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. You want to stay dry, you might as well. Well, I heard, okay, so when we did our Rise trip, it was just four of us. It was me and Kevin Romanek and Charlie Vetters and Bart Bridge. And it was the four of us. And when we were on our way back from the Rise, we were, you know, just talking. And somebody said, oh, the old timers say, if you're going to do this trip, you got to go out Speed Hollow. And we weren't about to do that because it was February. But I don't know.
That's a good reason not to.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because you do get wet to your neck.
Yeah. Exactly. So we weren't about to do that, but I mean, I guess I'm trying to find the validity to that. Was that a classic trip? You go in the classic entrance and then out Speed Hollow if you're going up to the Rise?
To some people, it might have been. I never considered a classic trip because, yeah, I've been out that way three or four times, but not from the Rise. Then once you get gone all the way up to the Rise, you just went out of the cave.
Yeah, that's how I felt too. And if I could admit something to you, I crawled through the backbreaker on my way out. I was not in shape at that time. I just wasn't feeling it. As much as I wanted to get out, I couldn't stoop. I'd had it.
Well, there's dozens of stories about what has gone on in Sullivan Cave. like the first expedition in 1962, that was, again, Mike Wishmeyer and Daryl Kirby and Rodney Grant and Lee Lawton and Bob Larson. And there might have been, so there were seven of them. I can't. Anyway, one of the things they did that helped us later on is they had a lot of extra food, canned food, and they hid it they dug a hole and hid it in the helictite passage. And so for the next year, we feasted off of their, of their leavings.
Still tasted all right?
That was before, you know, they were poor. These guys were all, you know, they couldn't buy freeze dried stuff, and that was uncommon anyway. So
yeah.
Well, their food was canned food.
They didn't want to take it out what they hadn't eaten, so no, just leave it there.
We made good use of it. And you got to realize also on the on that first expedition, they mapped beyond the quarry room. They mapped. They mapped up to the. Oh, somewhere up to the first bathtub or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And when they missed the main stream, they went through the first bathtub, they went through the second bathtub into the safety room, and they went down the slope in the safety room to a crawlway, which is now called safety room crawl. And they thought that was the stream passage.
Ah.
And they mapped it. If all they'd done is gone down the right portion of the, of that room, gone a little further and gone down the slope, and then they would have gone through a bunch of breakdown. And well, you went through where there's a, you come to an intersection and you go left and you go follow the breakdown and pass the Coliseum, a big room. And then eventually you climb up on a high mud bank.
Yeah.
And down below that high mud bank is the main stream. Well, there's another story. So see, they missed any of that I've just described.
All of it.
In December of that same year, Tom Ray, Mike Wishmeyer, and I were fastening up the wire for that was the telephone line that was laid to the quarry room, and we noticed this canyon that none of us had been in near the North Y, and so Wishmeyer and I went in it, and we. Let's see. I think Daryl Kirby was with it. So it was Daryl and I think went in it. Anyhow, we found what we now call the crevice connection. It and the bat room. And on later trips, we made the whole connection there.
Yeah.
But anyway, what I was leading up to was then the discovery of the beyond because we decided to continue the exploration.
Yeah.
And that was also in December of 62. We discovered the Beyond the Beyond stuff, beyond the quarry room, beyond the safety room and all, and the mainstream going to the Colossus and so forth.
Yeah. Why? And so the way to the Beyond, right there at the back of the quarry room, or wait, no, is that considered the way to the Beyond, the back of the quarry room, or is it?
Well, Beyond means beyond the quarry, and then Beyond the Beyond would have been beyond the safety room.
Okay. All right. Why is that area that's just at the end of the quarry room on your way to the Beyond called Bob's Fall?
Well, here's when we were setting up the 1963 Sullivan Cave Expedition, we were hauling gear. We set up gear and more phone lines. We literally spent we must have spent over a dozen weekends hauling gear and setting things up. So we didn't have to do it during the expedition. And Bob Larson, who'd been on the first expedition, was at that particular point in north of the quarry room where you climb down into the water and go through this deep water section. And he slipped and fell and dislocated his arm, his shoulder. Daryl Kirby took him back to the entrance. Anyway, it was my idea to call that Bob's Fall.
That was you. Okay. Yeah. I'm glad I've got the right guy then to ask.
In fact, there's several names on the map that I invented. There's a few. Bob's Fall is one of them.
Sure, sure. Oh man, there's so much I could ask you about that.
You got to realize Bob, he dislocated his shoulder only a week before we went underground for 3 weeks, and he was wearing normally was wearing a
like a sling.
A sling, yeah. Thank you. When we went in, he took that arm out of a sling and just kind of held it, and when we came out, he did the same thing. But during in the cave, he was pretty much the guy that took care of camps and dug latrines and that kind of thing because his arm was still injured.
And he still went
in the cave.
So the Sullivan Ears trips, the big ones.
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Something that people don't know about these people on the Sullivan Ears. On the first expedition, most of them were 15 and some were 14 years old and they were doing neat. Okay. So think about 1 year later. We had Daryl Kirby. He was 15. We had Bob Larson was, I think, 17. Wishmeyer was 18. All the others were 17 and 16 and 17. I was an old man. I was 20. Lee Lawton was right behind me at 19. And Dick Blends turned 40 while we were underground. And they were these guys... But they were ahead of their time as far as, you know, they were a bunch of young nerds, you know, they figured things out.
Yeah. What'd that do to you mentally to be down there for that long at a time? I mean, you know, you hear about the Lechuguilla expeditions and, you know, people staying in there for a week and a few days at a time. But I mean, you were down there. What your longest stretch was, what, 3 weeks?
3 weeks. Yeah. 21 days.
What'd that do to you? Do you remember?
We took a battery of psychological tests before we went in. After about 2 weeks, when the camp two had been taken apart and everything brought to camp one. And then after we came out, we also took those, about a week later, we took the battery of tests. It was never published. Mike Wishmeyer was kind of in charge of that and he kind of dropped the ball.
Ah, okay.
But some of the things that we did glean from them was that, you know, we were in our element. We got along. We had our own little society.
And that was just the understanding going into it. Like, hey, we're going to be spending all this time together. We're going to be the only ones. We're going to be off our circadian rhythms. And you just kind of knew that going into it. So you knew how to meet it.
Yeah, and we were definitely off the circadian rhythm because our days were long and our nights were long. But you got to realize we weren't all together in the cave for most of it. There was a group of six, I think it was, well, varied, but six at Camp 1 and 5 upstream, and that changed a little bit. But basically, in 2 weeks, we mapped all we could in the north end of the cave. Hmm. That's how we dismantled the Camp 2 and brought everything back to Camp 1, which was a chore in itself. Well, everybody pitched in, except one guy, and I won't name who. But anyway, at one point, while they were being dismantled, this one person was so tired, but we were on our way back to Camp 1, that it took us 14 hours to get him back to Camp 1. 14 hours.
God.
And this was from basically from the, not from Camp 2, but quite a bit south of Camp 2. Yeah.
Yeah. And so at this point,
it should have taken us about, if we'd rushed, about 3 or 4 hours.
And at this point, you had been in the cave for how many days?
Oh, this was at the, approaching the 2 week mark.
Approaching the 2. So you still had a week underground with this.
Oh, yeah. Guy. And when we got back to Camp 1 and got everything organized, basically we were still mapping into the south end of the cave. I was involved in mapping with one other person. A lot of the area were in the bat room, crevice connection area, the south end of Endless Crevice. All these names are on the map. But anyway, we were still mapping. We spent that last week cleaning up mapping.
So that was what your days were like. I mean, so you just went everywhere you possibly could.
Except the last 2 days, we really didn't have any off days where we weren't doing something. Except Bob Larson taking care of camp. Dick Blends in camp was plotting. You know, he and Wishmeyer were plotting our surveys on paper just to see rough it out. There's an interesting story about the that map that they plotted up in the cave, they took to a Central Indiana Grotto meeting and somebody stole it.
Oh.
Well, it all had to be redone, but still somebody stole it. They may have been, there was another possibility it was left behind and got thrown away by the janitors, but probably not. Anyhow, things just languished there for a couple of years. You got to realize that the souvenirs kind of drifted away. Rodney and Daryl went to join the Marines. They were in Vietnam. Some of the others, most of the others were just did not continue caving.
Man, it just seems like
their lives, you know, they went different directions.
Yeah. But it just seems to me like that would be something that would be so formative, or maybe for some people that would be, I don't know, all the caving you could do, because that's just a lot to do at once.
Well,
and
Dick Blends never did very much caving after that, only a little bit.
Really? Is that right?
Yeah. Well, he did a lot of digging at entrances, but he, of course, hosted the Speleo spot, but he didn't do very much caving after that.
But he would go in Buckner and stuff like that,
not so much, huh? Mm-hmm. Huh. You got to realize that this is after much of Buckner had already been mapped the first time.
Yeah, sure. Interesting.
But he did a little bit of caving, but he never did any hardcore caving after that. I guess that's what I should say.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Just all that lore, you know, behind those days, you know, the Speleo spot and the Sullivan Ears. I just get into it every time I hear about it. It's just fascinating to me.
The Speleo spot, it's just amazing the work that went into digging open things and the die tracings and the air tracings that went on. Dave DeMaray just opened things up when he started putting ethylmer captain in cave entrances and then going around sniffing where it might come out of sinkholes.
He would just go.
He basically told everybody that they're about the Blair system by doing that, you know, that there was a system, a large cave system above the Little Blair Spring.
Huh.
Yeah. And, you know, it's the Triple J. Well, the Triple J, it started out as Triple J and King Blair, and then they were joined, and it's the Blair system.
There's so many, just so many caves, long caves, significant caves just around that area. And so just the fact that Dick Blends owned Buckner and let everybody over and everybody hung out, is that why all of those were discovered?
there's some really important cavers got their start there.
Yeah, of course.
We mentioned Bill Steele earlier.
Yeah. Man.
And there were others. Steve Wells was involved with in the connection between Mammoth Cave and Flint Ridge.
Oh, my gosh.
And let's see. Ted Wilson did some work there, too, when he was quite a bit. He was what we called Barnites.
Yeah. What about the days of, and I'm sorry if this is a sore subject, but what about the days of Doug Love?
That's a big black spot on our history, really.
Yeah.
Doug is no longer with us. He's deceased. So yeah. I will say some things.
Yeah. That's fairly, he passed away when, I don't remember, but I found it recently.
I suspect that both his parents are gone now too. Well, Doug was an unusual person with a very unusual background who had an ego that required him to achieve somehow. Yes. And he decided to start the Cave Information Service. He even had that sign, Cave Information Service, on the sides of his vehicle. And he had a photographic mind. He went to the cave files at Dick's and went through the cave files, and he remembered just huge amounts of information and take it home and write it down.
Mm.
And he got information from other people too. And he could just, anything you said, he could remember some great time later.
Yeah.
And write it down. And so he took information and maps and made the caves of the Garrison Chapel region, a Spielenker's guide to the Garrison Chapel area. His picture's on it, incidentally.
Yeah.
And he took all these maps, redrew them with some topography, which was pretty crude, went into the cave in some instances and added some little feature of the cave and put his name on the map along with the others.
Gosh.
And in some instances, we don't think he changed anything and just put his name on the map.
Yeah.
Between he and his mother, they had this crude publication printed and distributed just widely.
Everybody got a hold of it.
Bookstores, the Jim's Market out on Highway 45. That's where Airport Road is, 45. It's not there anymore. And then he went to Cave River Valley area, Washington County. He made a book of that. He also did a publication that was pretty limited, though, on the caves of the southeastern part of the state. And all this became very public. Anyway, when Doug left this part of the world, his mother continued putting those books out.
Oof.
We still have people show up at Buckner with that book in hand.
Yeah.
Still.
Yeah.
And that's circa 19, let's see, 30. It's pushing 50 years old.
Yeah, early 70s.
Oh, yeah.
What was that like when that came on and you had these cavers trying to, I don't know, put a stop to it or something like that?
Well, there were various people trying to reason with his mother, and she would have nothing of it. The various people tried to reason with a couple bookstores, particularly around Bloomington, and they would not censor it.
Hmm.
They didn't understand, of course, but you got to realize Doug did have an area in it on lake cave owners and conservation. But you got to realize people don't read that. They just wanted to see where the caves were.
Yeah.
Yeah. The large numbers of them simply ignored anything but where the caves are.
Yeah. And it was very detailed, and he explained how to find it.
Detailed, yes.
Yeah.
If you read it, there's the congressional location with section, township, range, so forth. But some of them have enough other information. Some of the descriptions have enough other information to easily find the caves.
Mm.
And what he would not acknowledge was that this is all private property. He was sending people to private property, and the owners didn't have a say in it.
Mm, no good. Well, and when I talked to Dick Blends, he pointed at that book and Doug for the cause of the tragedy at Salamander.
Yes, that's probably quite true. It also, we know that people have been, went to Salamander that shouldn't, on more than one occasion, and got trapped by high water.
Mm.
Those people that died were just panicked and tried to get out.
Yeah.
And Salamander, well, let's see, the that whole area, which is not on the same property as Shaft and Grotto, all that area was kind of wide open. And he just made it worse, is what it was, you know, because, you know, yes, people knew about those caves and people went without any kind of permission. But apparently Doug's message was that you know, not really stated, but the tone of it was go.
Yeah.
Go look at all these caves.
Go check it out.
And yeah, he made almost no mention of organized caving.
It, well, because he wasn't really about that, was he?
No, he was never a part. He did visit the Bloomington Grotto a few times, but because they were trying to educate him, you might say, he quit.
Mm.
Yeah, the message wasn't what he wanted to hear, so he quit.
So that was it. All right, we can move away from Doug Love. We're
good.
But I always like hearing about that time and about the controversy that started. And I mean, I do think, I mean, as bad as it was and as bad as it got, and the fact that three people died in Salamander and people were trespassing on private property and all that, it had to have at least started the caving, I use the term careers, of some prominent cavers, you know?
Yes, it did actually. Not the ones that we've mentioned from the 1960s, but a few people. Well, like the guys that's working on Studebaker Pit.
Yep.
Like Drake and some of his buddies, they kind of got their start because of Doug Love's book.
Hmm.
But they also looked a little bit further, you know, than just Doug Love's book.
Sure, sure. That got them started, and then they took it seriously after that.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think I talked to Derek Bristol, and he, you know, when he got his start caving in Indiana, and he said that that book was a big part of what got him started. So there were definitely some bad parts about that book coming on the scene, but and I think the bad parts,
the problem with it was who it went to.
Yeah.
Without any real training or a good dose of cave etiquette.
Was it that book that brought so many of the problems to Buckner Cave?
It brought a lot of the problems, but it goes deeper than that.
Yeah.
You see, in about 1980, Jerry Estes was living at Dick's, and Dick let him build a music recording studio in the basement. And Jerry brought in local musicians. Well, the local musicians were all young and they wanted to party. And they were got to where they were, you know, telling their friends, and their friends were telling their friends about this place out there that you could go party.
Not the cave specifically, but just the property?
Jerry didn't intend to do that to happen, but it did.
Yeah.
And that's part of it. You know, that's a good part of it. Yes, Doug Love's books were part of it, too.
Yeah. So there's a lot of factors.
And there was also Buddy Rogers down the road who was sending people, he was selling cave gear and just sending people willy-nilly with, you know, out to trespass too.
He also sold spray paint in that store, right?
No, he didn't.
Oh, okay.
He didn't do that.
All right. I had heard that he sold spray paint in that store.
Not that I ever was aware of, no.
Okay.
But there enough people showed up with it. The spray paint's actually fairly recent, although it certainly dates to a time when Buddy was still selling cave gear and information.
Yeah.
I could tell you all sorts of adventures about different places.
What are some of your favorite ones to talk about?
Having the key to run around in Mammoth Cave at will.
Like the national park entrances?
Absolutely.
Yeah, really? So what'd you do?
Because I was involved in several projects there, and not CRF projects, to do things for, let's see, there was for two different archaeologic projects, for for a biology project. I was a photographer for a whole bunch of projects.
Yeah.
And also in the early days did a leveling survey of the various main upper levels in particular, and to some extent the lower levels of Mammoth. It's very high order leveling surveys to then compare them out to the terraces on the Green River. This is for Franz Dieter Miocki, who's published a long dissertation about the development of the Mammoth Cave system and the Green River, relative to the Green River and the Ohio River. I remember, Terry Lighthouser, we went into the most god-awful places in the lower levels of Mammoth Cave that you'd ever, as bad as any Indiana caving, sometimes worse.
I was going to ask if it was a lot of off the beaten path stuff that
you did. There's lots of nastiness, but we also, because I also had a project to do some photos for Jim Quinlan, who was doing the geologist and hydrologist for the region. We had basically a carte blanche to go almost anywhere to take photos for him, and did that for a couple of years. That's myself and John Bassett and Kevin Komisarik and Michelle Wright and Garrett Connor and Steve Clark, various folks. And we just had a hell of a time going to the most remote places that very few people ever went to and having a wonderful time because it was sanctioned.
Yeah.
And then Frank Reed and I did a bunch of surface survey, high order surface surveys to connect benchmarks and entrances and network of entrances and benchmarks in the Mammoth Cave for Mammoth Cave and related caves. And that was in the early 70s, and that was for the CRF. And we also did that in the Buckner region too, high order surveys to connect all those entrances.
Yeah.
This, I own the high order equipment to do that with, and the transit and all the neat stuff to go with it, which is kind of archaic now, but still works good. Yeah. And let's see, what else did we do? Photo trips and two radon projects for the National Park Service to look at comprehensive amounts of radon at different seasons of the year in the Mammoth Cave system. And the potential for making it. We actually sampled bedrock and stratigraphically in many, many places, and then looked at it at the IU cyclotron. That was Kevin Komisarik's thing. He was a physicist, and we looked at the potential production for radon in that system.
Huh.
It was really fun. We did that for Wyandotte also. Just did an extensive project in Wyandotte to look at the potential for radon and the existing radon.
What'd you find? Did you find anything that led anywhere, showed that it could be productive?
Let's put it this way. In the times of the year when there's the temperature outside and inside the cave, particularly Wyandotte, is similar, back at the Pillar of the Constitution, without any kind of filter, the big detector, a chip detector, would click off counts that... You may not understand this, but the way you sample the air through a filter, a membrane filter, and put it on a detector. Hmm. Without the membrane filter that has it concentrated, we were still getting high counts.
Oh, boy.
Okay. I can't quote numbers off the top of my head, but it was amazing.
Oh, boy.
But you got to realize that's something that unless you – spend lots and lots of time, it's not of consequence.
Yeah, you're not going to get a major dosage or anything like that. But no. Still, that's interesting. That's very interesting.
It's interesting, but the visitor does not have to worry about it. People who work in caves, that's a different story. That's many of the caves of like Mammoth Cave System, I think they still have a 800 hours per year underground limit.
Wow. All right. What's your deepest pit? Just curious.
El Sontano in Mexico, that's what, 1400 feet?
Oh, yeah. All right. Goodness.
I've done the Golondrinas a couple times. Lots and lots of other neat pits. I've spent a lot of my Christmas holidays over and New Year's in Mexico rather than with family. I used to anyway.
Yeah. And cave diving, too. You've done a little bit of that. Where have you done that?
Oh, for many years.
Quite a bit. I shouldn't say a little bit.
Here in Indiana.
Yeah. Well, you did
and,
the...
A little bit in Mexico, and done a lot of cave diving in Mexico and Florida.
Didn't you do that dome down in French Lick, or the pit down there? It's not really a pit. I guess it's a pit, but it's...
You're thinking of the Rise of Lost River.
Is that it?
That's 160 feet.
That's the one. Yeah. You did that one, right? Yeah.
I've not been but a few feet into that.
Okay.
Because of other circumstances beyond control, but have not been but a few feet into it.
Are you talking about the True Rise, right?
Yeah, the True Rise. It's difficult to get to.
Yeah.
It requires a boat normally, and you got logs in the stream that you have to haul boats over or cut the logs. I helped Bob Armstrong cut logs one time in that stream, and we found that a chainsaw doesn't work very well underwater. Not the motor. I mean, the chain itself doesn't cut very well underwater.
Well, yeah, you lose that bar and chain oil pretty quick, I would imagine.
Yeah, that too. But the wood is too malleable.
Oh, how interesting. I didn't think about it.
It gets malleable and it doesn't cut well.
Oh.
But anyway, I've done the longest. Chris Parks and I have done the longest sump dive in Indiana, which is basically 2,800 feet.
Really?
And that's at Blue Spring Cave, down at my place at Blue Spring Caverns.
Okay,
and
yeah.
That's from the spring into air, where you could then swim, you know, way upstream.
Well, okay.
I mapped all that myself. I didn't have any help mapping it. I just mapped all that underwater stuff myself.
You just went and did it.
Used to take me down there, and I'd go in the cave and map underwater.
Okay, so what's your relationship to Blue Spring Cave? Did you own it for a little while?
I am one of the owners.
You're one of the owners of the actual like tourist cavern.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's one of three of us. Yeah.
That's what I had thought, but I wasn't clear on that.
Tim Richards, Jim and I go back to the '60s, you know, like '65 or so. Between Jim Richards, Bob Hosley, and I started that business in 1974.
Okay. Still get plenty of visitors. I mean, right now it's a little complicated, but...
Yeah, we're open. We're open. June 1, we opened up, but not the gift shop, and it was strictly handing the tickets out through the window, and 8 people in a boat, which really holds 18, and now we're open up fully, but there's restrictions on masks and distancing.
Yeah, as there should be. And but that's great. I've done that tour once. And I've got standing offers from a few cavers who love Blue Spring to go in and check out some of the farther flung areas. And I can't wait to go. Cannot wait.
Pardon me for laughing, but it is not an easy cave.
Well, yeah, that's what I've heard. But I like them wet.
Not an easy cave. It is beyond the capabilities of newbies for sure.
Yeah, but I like getting wet, and so I'm here. Here's hoping I can hack it when I get the chance.
Yep, but there are some bodaciously large, beautiful passages after you go through the nastiness.
Mm-hmm.
Like the first discovery is 40 feet high and. Well, it ranges between about 15 and 25 feet wide, and you just stroll through it for, you know, over 1,000 feet.
Pyramid room, I've heard, is a good spot to visit.
Yeah, there's some fairly good sized rooms. Pyramid room, which is full of beautiful conical formations and such. Yeah. I wouldn't call it huge. It doesn't have huge rooms like Sullivan Cave does.
Yeah.
It's not huge like Sullivan, but it's a lot prettier.
A lot more water.
And a lot more water, yes. Much of it is a wetsuit cave.
Yeah.
I've been so fortunate. It's even the cave stuff's even drifted into my, you know, to some extent into my work at the Indiana Geological and Water Survey. And I'm retired there, but I'm still dealing with. I consider myself one of the luckiest people around, just, you know, for the experiences and outcomes. Just lucky as hell.
Yeah. When was the last time you went caving?
Other than Buckner.
You can count Buckner.
Hardcore caving. I haven't done any real hardcore caving for about a year, but I've been, about a year. Mm-hmm.
I went to, I did a little Sullivan trip back to the, it was my first trip to the quarry room, and it was with you and Paul Uglum and shoot, I can't remember, one or two other people. And it was in the fall of 2012. And I just remember because you were just telling stories about Sullivan and it was great. And I just sat there and listened like a fly on the wall the whole time. It was just a delightful, delightful Saturday.
Well, it's, I still love Sullivan Cave. I've been so many other places, but I still love Sullivan Cave. I kind of cut my teeth on Sullivan Cave, and that, in some ways, that helped me a lot of other places. I mean, it certainly helped me in the Little Mammoth Cave system because there are some similarities of, let me digress here. So when Sullivan, when the Sullivaneers were starting to drift in different places, what was left of us went, started, and one of them was Ron Flum. He wasn't on the expedition, but Ron Flum. Anyway, we started checking out a lot of other places up on the ridge and, you know, around and about Sullivan, and found all sorts of really neat things that are places that, yeah, some of them aren't places you'd really want to go. But there's really a lot of other caves in the area, you know, within that sphere of Sullivan Cave.
Sure.
A lot of other, they're not huge, but there's a lot of other caves in the area. And so that's, in 1965, we did a lot of other looking, and Flum and I and Lee Lawton to some extent did a lot of other caves in the area. Kind of got in with with Jim Richards and some of the old GL people, and we started going to places like Mexico and far southern Indiana, and I also got in with some Bill Steele and some of those people, the Chug people, Crawford Harrison Underground group, and we did a lot of down in there, that area too. And so Ben, I'm not bragging or anything, but I think my reputation got me places, you know, reputation of having been around a while and done a few things.
Where would you say is still the frontier in Indiana? I mean, when I talked to Dick, it was just a year, I think, before he passed away when I got to talk to him. Uh-huh. And he said Indiana's caved out. And I've had so many people tell me since they heard that Dick is wrong, and they were mad that he said that. So where's the frontier, would you say?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of entrances probably have been found, although every year some sinkhole opens up that's another cave entrance. Most of the discoveries that are done now, and there's some really good ones, are by digging.
Sure.
And sometimes not great great amounts of digging, not like Studebaker Pit where they dug 40 feet roughly.
But they made it.
The deep cave.
But they made it.
But anyway, like I say, there's places that people have looked for years that if you go back, you may find that new sinkhole that's opened up, or a sinkhole that needs a shovel and a little persuasion.
That's right.
But there are places to be found yet. There are caves to find yet. There is no doubt about that. Every generation lays the groundwork for the next. I hope I've helped lay the groundwork.
Are you kidding me? You've laid so much groundwork, and you're still here to tell the people who are currently laying the groundwork. So, good work.
Well, I got, you know, people before me like Art Davis and Bob Armstrong and Ed Lavanino and some of these old timers. They laid, and golly, don't forget Louis Lehman. They laid the groundwork for my generation. Now we're, you know, hopefully I've helped the next one.
Well, Sam, this was a pleasure, and
So too. Thank you for all the questions.
Yeah, of course.
It helps jog my memory.
He is the author of A Guide to Caves in Karst of Indiana, and he did all the stuff that he just talked about. Sam Freshour, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Oh, what a great time. Thank you, Sam, and thank you for listening, and I cannot wait for you to hear next month's episode with longtime tag caver Steve Davis. We had such a cool talk, and I can't wait for you to hear it. And I'm really looking forward to taping the episodes for November and December as well. Again, looking for a female caver for the December episode so that I can round out the year with 50-50 male-female representation on the Caving Podcast. Support the show by supporting our sponsors past and present. Of course, El Spilio. Go to elspilio.com. Use the promo code podcast to save $20 on any order of $300 or more or any regularly priced headlamp. Again, promo code podcast at elspilio.com. I'll put a link in the podcast description as well. Also support Swego. Buy a Swego pack if you do a lot of wet caving. They're perfect. And, of course, Organic Robot on Etsy. Charlie from My Grotto, the Central Indiana Grotto, makes a lot of really, really cool caving and outdoor-related T-shirts. Hit up Organic Robot, all one word, on Etsy. Let's see. Anything else? I think that's it. Yeah, if you need me to do a grotto presentation for you, I'd be happy to in COVID land. Until next time, kill nothing but time.